Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tom Prendergast, Executive Vice President from STV Inc., but former Chairman and CEO of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. We have an interesting session this afternoon with some excellent panelists talking about the integration and expansion of the commuter rail network in New York, with the possible exception of the commuter rail network in Chicago, where I was born and raised. It is an asset that not very many metropolitan regions have, and it's been an integral element in the expansion and the economic vitality of the New York region. Today's presentation will have Rich Barone, Vice President of Transportation, provide an overview. I'll introduce the panelists now. Each one of them will speak for about 3 to 5 minutes, talking about this particular subject, their agencies or their perspective. And then I'll ask them some questions, and we would really like to get to a point where we can open it up to questions and answers. On the panel are Kevin Corbett, Executive Director of NJ Transit. He was appointed Executive Director on February 14, 2018. He previously served as the Vice President of Cross Services at AECOM. And before that, he was the Chief Operating Officer and Executive Vice President of the Empire State Development Corporation and Executive Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Economic Development. Sarah Feinberg is the founder and owner of Feinberg Strategies. Prior to starting Feinberg Strategies, Sarah served for 2 years as the administrator of the Federal Railroad Administration. And prior to joining the FRA, Sarah served as the USDOT Chief of Staff. Patrick Foy is the MTA President, and he leads the innovation and modernization initiatives and supports the agency's daily operations and management. He previously served as an MTA board member, and also you all know him as the former executive director of the Port Authority. Seth Pinsky is an executive vice president of RXR Realty, and he is leading RXR's efforts to invest in emerging opportunities within the New York region. The intrinsic relationship between real estate development and transportation is known to all, and with some of the challenges most of the metropolitan regions have, that relationship needs to grow even further. Prior to joining RXR, Seth was director of Mayor Bloomberg's Special Initiative for Rebuilding and Resiliency, which developed a $20 billion plan to protect the region from climate change impacts. I'd like to now introduce Rich Barone, and he'll walk through the presentation of the report that the RPA did.
Thank you, Tom. So, I have about 5 minutes to go through an 80-page report, so I'll do my best to be concise. This is something that RPA's been working on for, years as part of the fourth plan, but also, as Secretary Clinton said a second ago, kind of pulling in a lot of the best practices from around the globe and our partners is what we did to actually kind of come up with this idea, this plan, and consulting with a lot of different folks around the nation, around the region, and around the world. As everyone knows today, the commuter rail system is very fragmented. We have three different railroads operating, differently, different policies, different fare policies. We have a situation where basically they all terminate within Manhattan. And we have a situation where even our intercity service, Amtrak service, really doesn't run through the core. What it does is it stops at Penn Station, as many people know, and sits there for 20 or 30 minutes. So if you're an unlucky person that has to make a trip from Stamford to Philadelphia, you got a nice 30-minute dwell on both ends of your trip. So we really don't have a real integrated network. There are many issues, specifically on the commuter rail system, things that we really need to address that to create this idea of a real regional rail network. Through service, like I mentioned, but we also have an equity of access throughout the region as far as city access. For example, we have rail stations in the city where there's very little frequency or the fares are extremely expensive. But access there would actually improve commutes dramatically for folks. We have a lack of redundancy throughout the network, something that was clearly shown during Superstorm Sandy, and we need to be thinking about that. We have an imbalance. For example, we have in some cases, as folks might be aware, we have something like 7,600 buses from New Jersey coming into New York City every day, but we have about 1,000 from the east and about 500 from the north. So it's a clear imbalance in how we're splitting our modal splits and whatnot throughout the region. As we mentioned before, there's a clear issue with the subway system in the core being at capacity, really crowded. And so how do we try to think about a network that would relieve some of this burden on the subway system as well? So again, what we want to do is move from our commuter rail to a fully integrated regional rail. We call it the Trans-Regional Express, T-Rex. The idea here is these are our goals. Again, it's really about jobs, it's about access, it's about affordable housing. It's about, basically making it so we address, public's anxiety when they commute today, the lack of reliable service, the fact they have to, basically be connected to their schedule, to be at the 508 train, for example. We want to go from something like that to where people just show up and get on a train because the frequency of the service is that good, and that folks will use the transit system or the commuter rail system for trips in the evenings, on the weekends, whatnot, because people are not traveling just in the peaks anymore. We're seeing that spread out throughout the day and over the weekends as well for discretionary travel. So how do we achieve these goals? Well, RPA started with the idea of services. So what kind of services do we want to envision and the kind of frequency of those services and all that? We came up with three different types of services. One is the metro service, which is really about creating a faster frequent service, essentially a super express subway, for lack of, even though it is the commuter rail system, but within the urban core. So it's not just about even New York City, but it's about access to, places in New Jersey as well, and Westchester and Nassau counties. And then we have something called the Regional Express, which is, again, it's our zone express system that we have today, but again, far more frequent and through running. And then the last level would be what we call the Trans-Regional Limited, which is the idea of inner city express service, in some cases a little bit like the Amtrak regional in certain places on the Northeast Corridor, but far more affordable, far more frequent, and going to places like, for example, Ronkonkoma, that doesn't go today. So those services together, make up the regional rail system, but, we can't, obviously, we have all these services and different ideas, but how do we support them? What are the infrastructure investments to make it happen? So it's a series of additional targeted physical improvements that we're suggesting in the fourth regional plan. And there's really three pretty significant investments in the core itself. Something called the Crosstown Line, the Manhattan Spine, the Jersey Loop. These are all, the whole point of these investments is to get through this barrier that we call, we're finally closing off the room, get through the barrier called Manhattan, because essentially that's a wall that inhibits real regional travel and mobility today. And the Crosstown Line is essentially the gateway project. It's really the first most essential part of that line. And then RPA suggests expansion of Penn Station 4 through running and some additional investments like additional East River tunnels and other improvements in Long Island. Manhattan Spine is a new corridor down 3rd Avenue from the Bronx to Brooklyn. And the Jersey Loop is a new series of tunnels underneath 57th Street to New Jersey, another set of tunnels underneath Houston Street. And I'll quickly go through sort of the phasing for this. This is the stuff that's planned. Folks are probably aware of most of these projects, the Gateway Project, the NAC Future Plan for the Northeast Corridor, Third Track, which is underway, Hudson Bergen Light Rail extensions as well, and East Side Access, Penn Access. On top of that, phase one would build out Penn Station, okay, as a through-running facility with a new station on the east side, on 3rd Avenue and 31st Street, and then new tunnels underneath the East River. And essentially, we're also looking at additional capacity on the long railroad, third line, fifth track main line, we call it. And then in New Jersey, potentially a new line in Monmouth County, and some additional improvements on the Northeast Corridor in Connecticut. Phase two would be the new tunnels underneath the Hudson River, 57th Street, connecting to a bunch of different railroads in New Jersey that are currently either underused or not used at all, and really creating a ton of new access opportunities from places like Patterson, which Governor Murphy mentioned earlier this morning, and also direct connection through to Lower Manhattan on 3rd Avenue and to JFK Airport. So you could theoretically do a trip from Patterson to JFK Airport directly. And the last part of it would build up the spine all the way up to the Bronx, and then a connection underneath Houston Street to New Jersey. And then we have a series of additional circumferential light rail investments like the Triborough, which you've heard about before, a new light rail in New Jersey, and then conversion of two long railroad lines into a new north-south route in Long Island. So this is a big series of investments. This is a vision, which we, for each one of those phases, we're saying the next 10 years potentially be phase one, 20 years after would be phase two, 30 years plus could be phase three. But it's a vision, it's a place for us to go and to debate. But even so, it's big. But if you look at it, we're only talking about an 11% increase in the number of stations in the system and a 13% increase in track miles. So we're building off a really substantial network that we have today, thousands of track miles and hundreds of stations. And with this investment, which again, you know, is substantial over several decades, there's huge benefits. This is some examples of the travel time savings. As you can see, they're pretty extreme, from 50 minutes from Northern Bergen to Midtown East to 11 minutes. I mean, these are massive changes that actually are going to, you know, basically transform the economic geography of the region and connect places that no one would think about going between today, opening up job opportunities, opening up housing opportunities throughout the region. So we're very excited about this. I'm very excited to hear what the panel has to say about it today and hear your questions as well. Thank you.
We'll now hear from each one of the panelists. Sarah?
Well, I think it's a great plan. I mean, this is one of the reasons, the RPA plan that comes out every couple of years is so useful, particularly for people like me and the panelists and others whose careers are about expanding service and trying to fund big transportation ideas. The RPA plan always gives us a good path forward. And it's hard to be against anything in that plan, right? You can nitpick things here and there that you might want to tweak. But I mean, this is about creating jobs and increasing capacity and better serving underserved communities. And so, you know, I think the plan is quite forward thinking and excellent. The issue is how do we get it done, and how do we actually make progress towards realizing some of this vision? And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot recently is that I'm not sure that we have all done a good job of communicating the urgency of where we find ourselves and how problematic our current situation is. I have said I think the Gateway situation is an existential crisis. I think generally the state of our infrastructure is become an existential crisis for the economy. And you know, when I look at a plan like this and think about it, it just reminds me that we need to take it upon ourselves to communicate about this stuff in a really aggressive way if we're ever going to make any progress like this. Many in the transportation infrastructure community are a little bit too polite, a little bit too patient. Even over the last year and a half, some people have been kind of hesitant to, I think, call a spade a spade and say, you know, the reality is it seems like nothing big is going to happen under this administration right now. And I think it's probably time for us all to start talking about the reality of where we are and the fact that this plans like this have to be huge priorities, and we have to be really aggressive about asking for the funding to make more progress, or we're just not going to get there. That's my initial reaction.
Thank you, sir. Kevin?
Yeah, I'll pick up on Sarah's theme, and Sarah, agree with you on sort of the existential crisis. Mm-hmm. As the old saying about it's hard to remember that your mission was to drain the swamp when you're up to your tail and alligators. And I think one positive note that I would say out of that, before making some specifics on the plan, is there's a saying about a crisis is often too good to waste. And I think this talks a little bit, before getting some of the specific aspects about the plan, just the concept, where is the need, what drives the plan. And I think a lot of that gets into when the Pennsylvania, where I think all of us in this room probably have read Conquering Gotham, and that rivalry between the New York Central and the Pennsylvania Railroad, and how the Pennsylvania Railroad went to all this trouble to get the New Haven Railroad to build the tunnel, even more than the current Gateway Tunnel, is also under the East River, an amazing feat. Where would that energy come from and everything it took to get that done? And now when we look to try to get something done, that was one organization, very powerful, one of the wealthiest corporations in the world at that time. And one of the big issues we have, I think, is on the softer side, is sort of the institutional issues. How are you going to get cooperation? And you have to walk you don't climb to the moon in one step kind of thing. And I think the crisis that we're, oddly enough, that we're in now, there are a couple of crises. One is, in my life, is positive train control. It is an unfunded mandate that came from Congress, and I think many of you are familiar with it, and I won't get into the weeds on it, but what it really is forced people that normally wouldn't cooperate or necessarily cooperate to the same degree on the same schedule to do so. And I'll give one specific example is with positive train control is there's issues at the Federal Railway, FRA will say, you know, who is the host rail line? And we have an example of that in where, as New Jersey Transit, we run a service on behalf of, when you cross over New York, on behalf of Metro North. And it's actually owned, though, by Norfolk Southern. So who is the host? There's a whole sort of legal issue. And I won't go into that now, but there's two ways you can deal with it. We could either, you know, fight back and forth and get lawyers and, you know, appeal and all that. And we just, fortunately, a lot of cooperation is also on the human level. And, you know, fortunately, you know, Catherine Aldi's a friend. She's over at Metro North. And say, well, you know, let's cut out the lawyers. Let's, you know, go back to the FRA and say, I can't put anything that's going to jeopardize the ability of Metro North to run after January 1st. And conversely, I can't let her do something that's going to put it on me that'll let, you know, New Jersey Transit get shut down after January 1st. So let's come together with a solution because it's an existential threat for both of us. That kind of cooperation is forced sometimes by these kind of deadlines. So I think if you look institutionally, you know, you hear things, oh, geez, it all become one agency, you know, like the Pennsylvania Railroad, one corporation. You know, you know, who knows what the future brings, but I think we start looking at some of the things that we've had to do, whether it be PTC or Gateway, where we're, you know, looking at how do we cooperate with Amtrak, with Port Authority, a lot of issues that Pat was involved with. I think those kind of institutional, rather than any, you know, dramatic, you know, coup that's going to take us from here all of a sudden, you know, fast forward at warp speed in the future, I think whatever progress has got to be, there has to be a driving need for it, that people see the need. I think it was Lee Sander who did the first train, I think it was Metro North, out to a Giant Stadium to prove that, you know, that this could be done. And obviously, there are a batch of obstacles, and the question is there a demand and compete with all the other competing interests and all the issues that the existing railroads have to do today? You know, how do you get from here to there with all those constraints? But I think you need to have some specific targets and have people working together where they see some real objectives, where there's a mutual benefit and efficiencies that you're going to get through this throughput can really be, you know, seen in a realistic time frame. That there'll be enough benefit that all the parties, you know, the railroads involved, can see significant benefit, because there will be costs and there'll be time, effort, not just financial costs, but taking staff, dedicated staff, is, you know, is going to be an issue. And the last thing I'd just echo on that, though, is going back to Sarah, any of us, and to my opening comment, we have so long, and I know preaching to the choir, but have starved our transit agencies that the idea sometimes of doing some great things when, you know, putting out the swamp to get funding. I'm very lucky that, you know, my boss is getting funding for me, Governor Murphy, you heard him this morning. But, you know, getting dedicated funding that allows people to look beside putting out fires to really, you know, planning for the next, you know, 10, 20 years out and have the resources to do that, credible resources to do that, is, to me, is the first step.
Thank you, Kevin. Pat?
Thanks, Tom. Two precatory notes. One is I want to recognize Veronica Vanterpool because I work for her. She's an MTA board member. Second, the first regional plan of the RPA was issued in 1929, and it recommended and advocated for the Verrazano Bridge and the George Washington Bridge. That was an incredibly important plan, impactful and actionable recommendations. I think that T-Rex is actually similarly visionary and will, in the years and decades to come, and this is a tribute to the work of Rich Barone and his team, I think it is an incredibly important and impactful document, and Rich and his team are to be commended. Let me address three high-level... Okay, that was a cheap applause line, but it worked. Let me recognize three kind of high-level, what are the things that could stand in the way of this? One is politics, second is finance, and the third is innovation and interagency cooperation. So I've been in public service for 9 years, and I'm not going to make the case that politics should not play a role in infrastructure, right? If you go back to the pyramids, you go back to the Erie Canal, you go back to the Transcontinental Railroad, Hoover Dam, every piece of infrastructure, where the bridge gets built, where the water supply is built, is a part of politics. Money is always limited at every level of government. How it gets allocated is a political decision. Here's the difference in the current world, which is unbelievably troubling. And it goes to Sarah's point about the existential threat to the region if Gateway is not built. What the federal administration in Washington is doing is not getting into an allocation of resources question, right? It's weaponizing infrastructure and infrastructure decisions to intentionally hurt the economic prospects of an incredibly important part of this region, which, by the way, goes from Virginia to Boston and beyond. And the weaponization of infrastructure as a political decision is something that has really rarely been seen in this country. Infrastructure has traditionally been a bipartisan issue. President Eisenhower built the national highway system after World War II, and there were questions, where should the road go, where should the entrance ramp be, where should the exit go? But there was a bipartisan agreement that the infrastructure should be built. Sadly, that no longer exists, and the urgent request that Sarah made that we all ought to be involved, I think, is unbelievably important. Second is, how does one pay for it, right? Rich and Team's report suggests that the TRUX is going to cost $72 to $74 billion over 30 years. That's an extraordinary sum of money. One, it doesn't include Gateway, which is the first priority. It doesn't include, for instance, state of good repair at Kevin's agency or mine or Amtrak. You know, Tony Kosha was with us today. So I believe strongly that the private sector, Kevin mentioned Conquering Gotham, which is a book about the Pennsylvania Railroad, a private for-profit company, right, which built the old Pennsylvania Penn Station, which built the tunnels under the Hudson that we're talking about replacing. A lot of the infrastructure, we're yards away from Grand Central Terminal, which was built by the New York Central Railroad. So private capital has had a significant role in building infrastructure in this city, in this state, in this region, in this country. The Port Authority and other agencies are doing P3s, LaGuardia, the Gotthals Bridge. I expect there'll be private capital at LaGuardia on the AirTrain, on JFK. I think Gateway's frankly a perfect candidate for private capital, as are a lot of the projects in T-Rex. And a lot of the projects that Kevin's agency and mine, the MTA, not all of them for sure. Second piece of financing is value capture. Value capture around the country and around the world has been a highly successful way to finance infrastructure. The New York subways were originally built by real estate interests to advance the interests of their the real estate that they own. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that given limitations on the fiscal resources of federal, state, and local governments for as far as the eye can see, and a $74 billion cost estimate for T-Rex, for instance, recourse to private capital and value capture and similar techniques is going to be absolutely essential. And the third thing is innovation. We can't keep doing the same thing. There's been a lot of criticism, some of it well justified, about large MTA projects and those of other agencies. As the new sheriff in Pine, Jano Lieber is now in charge of MTA capital construction. We've got to be more efficient. We've got to look to private sector innovation that comes in certain cases with private capital. Increased use of design build, which is a priority of the MTA and Governor Cuomo. I think it's a great thing that Commissioner Trottenberg has got it design build with respect to certain New York City projects. And lastly, I look forward to discussion on the panel about the part of the proposal about merging Metro North and Long Island Railroad. I'm skeptical in New Jersey Transit. I'm skeptical about that. I actually don't think it's worth a candle. But a high degree of cooperation and collaboration based in part on personal resources, relationships rather, as Kevin suggested, I think is incredibly important. I think if you look at the Transcom model, that you have situations in which there are existing structures. Transcom is an agency that New Jersey Transit, the Port Authority, the MTA, Amtrak, everybody kind of plays in for mutual benefit. I think we need to see more of that in the region and around the country. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Pat. Seth?
Great. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Congratulations, Rich, and the whole RPA team on a really interesting proposal with T-Rex. I want to come at this proposal from a slightly different angle. And I think that one of the problems, and we've spent a lot of time today talking about why it is that people aren't more focused on infrastructure. I think one of the reasons why those of us who care about infrastructure haven't been more successful is that infrastructure is kind of an abstract concept, and we don't do a very good job relating that abstract concept to people's everyday lives. I think we need to spend more time talking about the fact that infrastructure, when we say infrastructure, we're talking about people's quality of life, people being able to get home to their family, get to work, et cetera. When we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about economic development, because without infrastructure and the ability to move people and goods, our economy would grind to a halt. But there's a third area that I think infrastructure is critical for, and it's this is another topic we seem to be touching on frequently today, or another phrase that we're using a lot, but another one of the existential challenges facing our region that infrastructure is really the key to solving, and that is affordability. The whole dynamism of this region is dependent upon the talent base that we have, and the talent base that we have is in part dependent on being able to attract and retain people and allowing them to live here in a manner that it doesn't bankrupt them in the process. And the reason we have an affordability crisis in the region is, and Scott mentioned this during his remarks, it's not because we don't have enough rent-regulated units, although you know that's obviously part of the solution set. The reason fundamentally we have an affordability crisis here is because we have a mismatch between the supply of housing, especially supply of housing in the places that people want to live, and the growing demand. And the challenge that we face is that we keep trying to fit more and more people in a relatively fixed area, and supply can't keep pace with that demand, and as a result of that, costs go up. And when I joined RXR after having spent my entire career focusing on New York City, one of the assignments that I was given was to look at opportunities in the suburbs, and I have to admit to my embarrassment that for a good 6 months after starting, I resisted in every way looking at anything beyond the borders of the five boroughs. But what I've come to conclude is that if we as a region want to address our affordability challenge, the solution has to run through the suburbs as well as through the city. And the kind of development that we need to do in the suburbs is dense development around our transit nodes, which are one of the great underused resources that we have in the region. And what I find so interesting and exciting about the T-Rex proposal is not only that it makes more transit nodes more accessible by cutting down commute times, because, and this is a very important point to make, when people think about where they want to live, they think about proximity to the things that they care about. But proximity for them is not determined based on mileage, it's based on time. You don't care that you live 10 miles from something, you care that you live 10 minutes from something. And what's interesting about transportation is that if you do transportation right, you can actually cover a larger geographic area in the same amount of time or in less time. Just by way of example, I live in Park Slope in Brooklyn. My commute to Midtown Manhattan is, when the subway is working, 40 to 45 minutes. I'm not that far physically from Midtown, but in some of the communities where we're developing in the suburbs at RXR, like New Rochelle or Yonkers, they're physically farther, but they're only a 30 to 35 minute commute thanks to infrastructure. And the key for us, I think, really to solving this is a combination of two things. One is that we need to improve our infrastructure so more places are proximate. To the extent that we can expand and make better the infrastructure that we have, That just allows us to spread development over a larger area. And the way that I like to think about it is that today what we're trying to do is, and obviously this is not an accurate way of describing it, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to fit 10, 100-story buildings into certain areas in order to accommodate growth. And the beauty of being able to spread development out with infrastructure is that instead of building 10 100-story buildings, we can build 100 10-story buildings. And politically, that's a much easier task. So task number one is to improve our infrastructure, to expand the number of places where we can do this development. And again, that's something that T-Rex does. And then task number two is it's making sure that around those transit nodes, we have the appropriate zoning and regulatory environment and infrastructure such as sewers to ensure that once the transit is there, you can actually build the developments around that transit. The one thing that I just want to say to a point that Pat made, and I 100% agree with him about the value of value capture as a way of paying for infrastructure expansion. Something that I learned in the work that we've been doing around the region, which I didn't fully appreciate before we started to actually do it, is that in many places along our suburban transit lines, the value of the land is actually negative. And the reason for that, and it's maybe counterintuitive, is that the land that's available for development is currently being used as parking. And in these communities, understandably and appropriately, if you're going to develop on that land, you have to replace that parking. The problem is that these communities aren't willing to accept sufficient density to allow you to cover the cost of the replacement infrastructure that you have to put in. So if we want to use the value capture model, which we should be using, a piece that you have to put in place that makes it politically more difficult is that you need to have sufficient density to allow you to cover the in-place costs that are necessary to unlock that value in the first place.
Thank you, Seth. Each one of our speakers has talked about the report in general, provided their comments regarding it, and going forward. I'm going to ask them some questions to get the dialogue started, and we'll open it up to questions from the audience. But I'd like to frame it a little bit narrower. As someone who's worked his entire career predominantly in the public sector, in public transportation, over a generation, you may see a lot of change. But over a year-by-year case, you don't see that much change. You don't see that much change. There were things that were given in my mind, like the Highway Trust Fund will always be solvent, it will always be sustainable, and you'll always have money to use from. And that was proven wrong. The issue of a suburban to urban commute, where people, first thing my generation did when we graduated from school was buy a car. Then we worked for single for a while, and we got married earlier rather than later, and we moved outside. And we would use public transportation Monday through Friday to and from, but on regional trips, I've lived in Chicago and New York, very large, dense metropolitan areas, we'd use a car, because the transportation network wasn't really suited for being able to provide that time distance that Seth was talking about. And those were so much given in my mind, and I was so myopic, it wasn't until some of the last 20-year needs assessments that the MTA did that really opened my mind. You know, over a period of time, we saw reverse peak commute become a priority, like on Metro North. And the 20-year needs assessment that the MTA does two things. First of all, it's the state of good repair. What do you need to do to invest in the infrastructure to maintain it? The second thing is, what do you need to do in terms of investment in the infrastructure to expand or enhance to meet the needs of the region 20 years into the future? And for somebody who was responsible for operating a system, the latter was a little bit lost on me. But when we started to get the impact from the growing portion of the society that we are now addressing, because I was a boomer and that's what it was the millennials, their interpretation of what they wanted was totally different. They were getting married later, they weren't buying cars, they were willingly transit dependent, and they would ask questions like, why doesn't the public transportation system accommodate and provide for a larger service area in the off-peak within the region? And that forces you to look at things differently. So one of the things the RPA has done with this particular study is cast the net very far in terms of you know, what we need to be looking at. Because if you set your goal on something that isn't aspirational, you certainly will achieve that. But if you set your goal on aspirational, even though if it takes 30 or 40 or 50 years, you haven't precluded the ability to be able to get there. And I think that's the way that we need to look at this particular report. So some of the questions I'm going to ask the panelists really are within that frame of mind in terms of that incremental approach of how we want to move toward that aspirational goal, do it in a way that is reasonable, because Pat is right. There's some things here that it's a reach too far. You're not going to easily change governance issues in the metropolitan area of New York. It's just not going to happen, although you may want to. So what are the steps agencies can take, and what are the steps we can do now that can move toward that, not losing sight of state of good repair, but achieving that secondary issue, which is providing for the needs of the region at large and the people who will be prominently using it. So from that standpoint, Kevin, you know, what do you think are the things that initially NJ Transit can be focused on and doing to be able to take those steps leading in that direction, recognizing you can't do it in one step?
Yeah, well, you know, Tom, thanks. And as you well know, the state of good repair, you know, and safety is, you know, what you when you're running an operating entity is what you live and die by and, you know, lose sleep at night by. So that state of good repair and that demand is, you know, so paramount to anybody who's actually running a railroad transit system. But I think, you know, and I totally agree with Pat about you know, what's it worth to try to, you know, put everything together in one miracle, you know. I don't see that happening. But as a parallel, I touched on, you know, the example of PTC, and I look at, you know, Amtrak, certainly New Jersey Transit, we operate. We have freight railroads, one of the most complex systems in the country on the rail side, to say nothing of the bus aspects. But where we have freight railroads, we have Amtrak, we have, you know, Metro North Service, we have our own various services. We have the interface with PATH, the Port Authority. So, you know, the idea that you're going to put all those agencies and resolve those, you know, on a governmental level, that's beyond, you know, I will not be alive to see that. That I'm willing to bet a fair amount of money on. But when you think of Easy Pass, right, how many people into where, you know, with what Rich has put in the plan is the idea more where people can go to their center of transportation node and be less schedule reliant and more on having more consistent service and have a pattern that they know where they can, you know, sort of the hub and spoke or whatever, you know, the variety of things that are in the plan. But people don't really care if they, you know, if they use a Metro card or what kind of card or, you know, payment device. You don't care when you drive Easy Pass if you're going up through how many states to go to Boston. And I think a lot of those kind of issues are where you're gonna see for the passenger, how do we communicate, allow them to communicate. I think a lot of you can do with technology advances that are coming, and how do we allow it so for the customer, to them it's invisible. We may have our own different governance structures, but the interoperability, I think, is the big challenge. And I think there are various things that we can look at on the interoperability side. At transit that I think we're working with Amtrak, with MTA already on it, and certainly with PATH. So I think by taking some of those smaller things and then looking, building that sort of relationship and functionality that sort of, you know, as Pat mentioned, Transcom, those kind of things can help you identify something. You know, I'd say specifically, I'll throw that out there, you know, for those of us who have a bias, you know, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, Senator or Secretary of State Clinton mentioned that. I would just say the 20th anniversary, the Army-Navy game is going to be at MetLife Stadium on December 11th on a Saturday. So, you know, I want to see a Metro North train bring, you know, the people from Army who are going to come down and lose the Navy. If they want to bring that out to MetLife Stadium, I'm willing to play a hand in that.
Pat?
I'd say a couple of things, Tom. One is customer expectations. I think we all live in a world where if you call Amazon and order a book, you're going to have an unbelievably consistent and seamless experience online ordering the book. It's going to show up when it's supposed to. You're going to get billed the correct amount. Our customers don't have those experiences often with respect to services by governmental agencies, including the MTA and including, well, I'll speak for the MTA. On the other hand.
You can speak for me, it's all right.
No. No.
Neither of us will speak about the Port Authority.
I'm going to make lots of mistakes. I'm not going to make that one. What I will say is we've got two new rock stars, Andy Byford, who spoke earlier this morning, and Phil Lang at Long Island Railroad, and Catherine Rinaldi, who's the new president. And we're doing things like this. if a customer complains on Twitter that there's a problem on a subway car or a Long Island Railroad or Metro North car, we now try as much as possible to answer in real time and respond to the customer. That is, in MTA world, kind of unprecedented, but that's what we expect, right? That's what we expect from Amazon. It's what we expect from Google. It's what we expect from Uber. So we're trying to meet the customer's expectations. Second is government agencies, even the best of them, are slow and lunky compared to Uber and Microsoft and Amazon and others. We've got to be quicker. On the other hand, the projects that we all work on are long-lived assets that often involve the investment of billions of dollars. In the case of T-Rex, like $75 billion, which is, I realize, a rough estimate. Those are extraordinary sums of money. It's going to take a long time, or the state of good repair work that we're doing on the subways is going to take a long period of time. Our customers don't have the patience that they may have had 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. We've got to be quicker. Our customers also expect, everybody's got a device. Everybody's aware of the innovations that's happening in New York, in Silicon Valley, in Korea, in Japan, in China, et cetera. We expect the same thing from our government agencies. In lots of cases, we can't deliver that. But at the MTA, we're looking at things like 3D printing, for instance, for subway parts that have been out of production for decades. We've met with two or three of the leading 3D printing companies, and we think, frankly, then rather than having MTA technicians create these parts, we can have them 3D printed. We're looking, as at railroads around the country, including the freights, which are ahead of us, we're looking at drones and in tunnels and above ground to see what drones can do and what artificial intelligence can do in terms of making the drones smarter on the second trip and the 20th trip. And then we're also doing things, I mentioned Transcom, which I think is a real success story, but at the MTA we're moving to new fare payment where you're going to be able to use your smartphone or your Apple Watch to pay, right? The first phase of that, there are actually 100 devices around the system for MTA people to use smartphones to see how they're working. But the first phase of that is going to be rolled out in 2019. The project was approved in October. It's on time and on budget so far, and we're intent on keeping it that way. And these are steps that we're taking to meet the expectations of our customers, who in their personal and work lives, when they're not dealing with government agencies, have an expectation which is mostly met every day with every experience they have on Amazon and Uber. It's not perfect, but there's such a high degree of consistency and quality, and we've got a long way to get to the same level.
One of the points Pat raised was this issue of being able to provide more instantaneous, more real-time information about your service. And I came from the old school. They had 42,000 employees when I was president of New York City Transit. Andy's got that now. And it's like you were lucky enough if you could communicate that information across your own organization. So I was like slow to the take on that. I was like, it's not that important. We'll get to it later. But then what happens, because in a vacuum, people will report that information for you. Your other customers will tell you what's going on with your service. And about 90% of the time, it's not close to being right. So you get forced to be able to do it. You'll get forced to do it because you want to have accurate information out there. Sarah, Seth, do you want to add anything along those lines?
I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, I was just sitting here remembering back to my time at FRA when, obviously the role is different than running a huge service, but we would find that we needed to respond in real time, usually via Twitter as well. And it's, I don't think it's acceptable in 2018 to not be able to do that. And it's, as Pat was saying, I can't even imagine how difficult it is to be responding to your customers in real time as they're complaining about, whatever's happening on the 7 train or the 4 or whatever. But if you can manage responding to those customers in real time to the best of your ability while avoiding sinking so many resources into that response that you're having to take them away from other places, it's, helpful.
If I could just add two things to answer the question about things that we can do to help jumpstart this. The first is, I just want to come back to this $73 billion price tag. I mean, if we want to do anything meaningful in this region going forward, whether it's this project or Gateway, we need to figure out how we can do what you saw on the screen for a lot less than $73 billion. It shouldn't cost that much. It doesn't cost that much in other places. I know Pat and Kevin and others are looking at the reasons things cost as much as they do here. The good news for us is that a lot of the things are actually well known, and many of them are just rules that we impose on ourselves and have over time for various reasons imposed on ourselves, but which we can just as easily stop imposing. And I'll just make one quick point. My experience was not in transportation, but my government experience was running the New York City Economic Development Corporation. And what was really interesting about that job was that we had a $2.5 billion capital budget, which I guess by the scale of the people up here is a small capital budget. But the work that we did was largely the same work as what other city agencies did. We built parks, we built roads, we built water tunnels. And every time we did a project, it cost us less, and we got it done faster than the equivalent city agency was able to do it. And the only difference between us and those agencies, it wasn't that we were smarter or that we paid closer attention, it's that EDC was set up intentionally not as a city agency, but as a not-for-profit, and therefore it wasn't subject to the same rules and regulations as city agencies. And because of that, we were able to be more nimble and more effective. We didn't sacrifice safety, we didn't sacrifice quality. We got the same product that everyone else got, but we got it for substantially less money. And so the first point I would make is that we have to figure out how to do this stuff less expensively, because if we don't, there are not enough resources in this region to do what needs to be done. So that's number one. Number two, just be a little bit of a broken record. I think the other thing that we need to do is prove the value of this infrastructure and prove what the potential of this infrastructure is. And I come back again to this issue of affordability and the opportunity that we have around our suburban rail stations. One of the many obstacles to development in the suburbs traditionally was that there was opposition in the suburbs to anything that smelled even a little bit like urbanism. People moved to the suburbs to get away from the city, not to bring the city to them. And what's happened over the last 10 or 20 years is that the traditional suburban model has largely broken. The significant parts of the population no longer want to live the way that the suburbs are structured. They're having a very hard time retaining young people. They're having a very hard time retaining aging empty nesters. They're losing an important part of their workforce, which means that they're also having a hard time attracting businesses. That's meaning that, the result of that is that their tax bases are stagnating, their costs continue to go up, and that's why we see that 10 of the 10 most expensive counties in the United States on a property tax burden basis are in the New York region. And so now what we're seeing is an opportunity politically to rethink these transit nodes and to bring density to these suburban areas. And I think if we do that in a few communities, the rest of the region will see just how valuable these locations are. And that will allow us, one, to replicate this in other places around the region, but two, also to make a much more effective argument for why we should be creating more of these transit nodes. Because if we do that, we have more opportunities to create value for these communities. It's not about burdening them, it's actually about lifting the burden on these communities and giving them a future. And so those would be my two recommendations. Think about how to do this less expensively and show why infrastructure is important beyond just making the argument that, well, infrastructure is infrastructure and we should all care about infrastructure.
Yeah, I just want to build on Seth's point, and I agree. There isn't $74 billion to be spent. We got to figure out a way to do it cheaper. One of the answers is competition, right? And competition can take many ways. For instance, if you look at T-Rex, there's an awful lot of tunneling there, right? If we were to adopt it, you'd want to go long tunneling machines, right? That'd be a good thing to own. Tunneling is extraordinarily expensive, the record shows, in this part of the world, but there are alternatives to some of it, right? One alternative that's competitive is maybe bus rapid transit is an alternative. The downside is the academic research, right? The academic theory and the research shows that you don't get the same investment around a bus rapid transit that you do against a fixed hole in the ground or a tunnel, right? Because investors can make long-term decisions. If a subway exists, then a bus rapid transit route can be changed. But that's one form of competition. And you can go to the construction industry and related vendors, et cetera, and say, you know, look, we want to build this project. We can do it as a tunnel. We can do it as back bus rapid transit. A second source of competition is the one I mentioned before, which is public-private partnerships, private investment, private innovation, which I think will, on balance, most often bring down the cost of being able to achieve those things. But there is not the ability, especially the $74 million numbers in some ways is a misleading one, right? Because it doesn't include Gateway, and that was clear in the report, but it also doesn't include tens of billions of dollars of state of good repair that the MTA, New Jersey Transit, Amtrak, and other governmental agencies are going to have to commit over the period of 20 or 30 years.
I think we'll take some questions from the audience. If anybody wants to add to this discussion or go in a slightly different direction. Rich, you get a microphone right here. Please identify yourself.
Sure. I'm Howard Herman, and so I used to be president of Metro North and familiar with many of these issues. But one thing that no one has yet talked about is the whole issue of the partnership with the unions. And as somebody who did a variety of different trying to build partnerships or joint services, one of the critical questions is how you work with the unions and how you put that together. So I would interested in the panel's thoughts on that as you look at an integrated service that was laid out in the report.
Well, I would definitely put it in the same category of difficulty as governance, maybe with an asterisk next to it, because it is a challenge. But I think what we look for is, you know, with every crisis, there is an opportunity. And I think sometimes a number of the panelists said we don't articulate our position well enough. And articulation can be positives, but articulation can be negatives as well, lack of action being taken in a certain area. But it is certainly one of the more difficult issues to deal with because it always has been. And in terms of, you know, all of these agencies have the right to strike, which is kind of unique in the New York area, for example. So it's not insurmountable, but it is definitely a difficult challenge. Anybody else want to add to
that? Yeah, so I'll jump in. I agree with Tom. Tom's right, of course. I'll make the following example, and I think this may be hopefully just one of many success stories. So largely due to the work of Phil Eng, the new president of Long Island Railroad, but before he went to the railroad a week or two ago, Phil was COO of the MTA and was really the leader of the Subway Action Plan. So working closely, in the interest of full disclosure, I went to college on a union scholarship, so I'm gonna talk about progress and a really terrific thing that happened on the Subway Action Plan. Historically at the MTA over the last 20, 30 years, on a general order or track closure at night on the subways, we've gotten 2 hours of productive time on a 7-hour closure. Working closely with the unions, and really there were no issues or confrontations or grievances, Phil and his team on the Subway Action Plan was able to increase that 2 hours of productive time to pretty close to six. And I think there's probably a little bit more to be squeezed out, and that was done in close cooperation with the unions. If we're able to continue that, assumed, and we're able to extend it, that's an unbelievably important thing for the MTA, measured in hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps higher. One, dramatically lower customer inconvenience, right? Because if you're able to get more productive time while the track is closed, you'll have to close the track less, so there'll be less customer outages. And you'll be able to attack things like, for instance, resignaling, which is a major priority of Andy Byford and the MTA board and Governor Cuomo in a dramatically shorter period of time. It is a big assumption to go from the work on the Subway Action Plan, which is this emergency plan that was announced by Joe Loda and the governor last July. But the progress that's been made on the Subway Action Plan in general, but especially in the near tripling of productive time coming out of the general orders at night, is an extraordinarily positive thing.
Yeah, and you know, Tom, I may chime in on top of that with Pat. I sort of feel somewhat similar to Pat on it. I look at you know, two factors. One sort of general, you know, my background started in the maritime industry, and I did a lot of collective bargaining. That's where technology was introduced, you know, containerization from break bulk, and those were, you know, often very tough labor negotiations, but ultimately there were, you know, it was protected so that the jobs were protected and that, you know, there would be training and they would evolve within that workforce, and that, but, you know, the technology was adopted. And I see that now, specifically on New Jersey Transit side, there are two issues I find very encouraging, is working with labor on issues in New Jersey Transit. We still collect, you know, paper tickets, and you can show your iPhone, we have it online, but they still punch the, you know, and, is, you know, obviously, you know, like Amtrak, other places where you can scan. And, you know, we are going to be accelerating now that they're trying to accelerate, you know, the introduction of that, and hopefully doing some prototypes this summer. And I found, you know, the labor, the conductors, if you're out on, you know, you get to know the conductors. I ride the train every day, and you hear what are the issues. And if you're reasonable, I think labor will actually work with you. It may not be easy, but they'll be there. Same thing with sleep apnea. You know, we're saying, how do you have safety? And there are different issues. You go back and forth, but I think there's a common interest in, you know, in the safety of the passengers and in wanting to be take pride in your in the transit system you work for. So I think ultimately you can get, it's not easy, but you can get there with labor.
I can assure you they know you, Kevin. They know when you're bored, when you're light, and where you live. It won't take more than a few days for that to occur. Another question? Rich, up here.
Okay. No. Can I take? Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
This is not comfortable. Good afternoon. My name is Christine Berthe. I'm from Czech Peds and from Hell's Kitchen in. My question is directed more at Mr. Corbett, is how do you do technology improvement when the technology is really crossing silos? And what I'm talking about is that if you take all your buses, and at what point do you decide that it should really be upgraded to trains or to subways? Because buses are, you know, a certain capacity, have certain flexibility, but at a point of time you cannot use that anymore. And indeed, if you have people which are just working on buses, they are going to think about upgrading buses, not moving that whole problem to trains and transportation. So that's my question.
I'm not sure. There were a couple of questions in there, so I'm not sure, but I'll take a stab at it. I think, you know, there's a lot of bus technology, and you can go even to where we're looking at, you know, driverless, autonomous vehicles, things like that. But, you know, living in the world that I live in, there's a lot of technology with cameras, with your iPhone, on being able to know exactly where the buses are. But I think most people are sort of mode neutral. I even do that myself, you know, today. I mean, I'll switch, you know, depending on, you know, if it's weather's out or what the bus. If I just miss a train, I know it comes every 20 minutes, I may switch to a bus or walk part distance somewhere else. So I think the technology is there, and it's just, to me, it's almost being more mode neutral. How do we address our customers' needs, regardless of which mode? So,
yeah.
No, I think there's, oh, that gets into, I thought you actually answered your own question. Sorry. that we have, you have models. You look at your origin and destination. We constantly recycle the data to see if you're shifting patterns. We see that now also with the experiment that's going on at Summit Station, where we're, the town of Summit is, the city of Summit is offering, you know, free Lyft. It was Uber, now Lyft. And so we're looking at the pattern. So bus gives you flexibility. You can move less people, but you can be a lot more flexible. Some people, whether it's bus to rail or bus direct into New York, certainly northern New Jersey in our case, you really don't have, a lot of places you don't have a rail option. So bus is the only option versus auto. And then between auto, between the rail and the bus, you know, I think most people look at their app and they, you know, they'll see which is the quickest way to get them there. And it depends if they like the bus or like the train.
The most expansive BRT system in North America is in Ottawa, and I'm working on a project of changing that over to LRT. And what drove the decision was, when in the peak corridors you exceeded the capacity of that corridor with the number of buses, that was the point at which you had to change over to rail, so you could get increased volumes, increased throughput. 30 years ago, people would jump at the idea of building LRT, even if it wasn't fully justified, expecting it to build out to that. Today, there's not enough money to do that. But that's generally the sequences. It's bus rapid transit, and then it's LRT. But this is the first whole-scale changeover in North America. A lot of people are watching it. It's really, because you've got a built-up ridership base. You've got a demand that customers expect to be fulfilled, and overnight, they're going to switch over from BRT to LRT.
It's also, Christine, a question of capital and capital availability, right? it's relatively cheap to start a bus route, even a bus rapid transit route. Rail, especially if you're digging on the ground, is really expensive and takes a long time. It's also, unfortunately, a lot less flexible.
100 million a mile above ground, a billion below ground.
George.
Rich, a very good plan, and I haven't gone through all 88 pages yet, but I promise I will. This is a question for Pat and for Kevin. Right about 200 feet away from us here, you could x-ray your eyes down, right underneath the Oyster Bar, there's a lower level of Grand Central. There are 8 tracks that have a bumper block there. If you go over to Penn Station, tracks 1 through 4, or maybe 5, or even one more, have bumper blocks, don't go anywhere, they stub there. Tom's tremendous organization, he worked for once upon a time, Parsons Brinckerhoff, which was the largest engineering firm in the United States at that time, came up with a plan to connect those bumper blocks with this 1.2-mile double-track line. So it allowed people from New Jersey to stop at Penn, go to Grand Central, and then keep on going to points north. Only 35 pages of that plan have ever been published. The rest of it, as I'm told, there are 1,600 pages of detailed analysis. In the interest of transparency, Kevin and Pat, could we ask you to promise to make that information available to the public?
So this is an oral FOIL request. Look, let me answer it that
about
way.
The seventh or eighth time of it, by the way.
I don't know who's got the information, what agency's got it. It seems to me if the NTA's got it, it ought to be released. But I'll leave that to the lawyers.
Take one or two more questions and that's it, because there's a, go ahead. Oh, you.
Oh, me. Deborah Wathen Finn. Some of us in this room may remember 79 to 83. And I'm just gonna give you a little bit of a history lesson. I never thought I'd be the one giving the history lesson. But we sat here in meetings, like we are today, about the crisis, and I love that you all said this. And private sector was running the railroads. You all have alluded to that. And that's when bold thinking happened. Believe it or not, New Jersey Transit's creation of New Jersey Transit, Metro North, Long Island Railroad, all those railroads or organizations came together and public took it over. We got all kinds of money because we framed the issue. I was just a kid out of grad school, so I got to follow Lou Gambaccini around on this one. But I when you all said, "Let's governance is too tough," that was a really hard time. What we had to go through, Ravage, Lou Gambaccini, others in this region, to create those institutions and get money so we rebuilt the infrastructure. And no one, and so since, I won't mention the governors, but since some of the governors are no longer here that were in those positions, we aren't making the case for the infrastructure. And I'm gonna juxtapose, I went on the Asia study mission with APT this year, or last year, and what we saw in Hong Kong and Tokyo was the opposite. Private sector model was set up to create organizations, a different governance model. And I would love a conversation going on in this region over the next couple of years to respond on the institutional piece. Maybe we should really think differently. Because if we frame it to the public, they want a different model. And you all alluded to that. So I'd love for you to comment on it. This is actually a conference.
I'll take a shot at it.
I was going to help you, Pat, by defending you and let me say it so you don't have to say it.
No, it's okay. I love bold, ambitious things, but here's a practical realization. In government and politics, it is really hard to take things away from people. But the governance that was created with respect when Penn Central and the other railroads failed, right, was done out of crisis. Now what you're going to have to do is go to the governor of this state or that state or this representative and say it's going to change. And then the question is, you're going to have a discussion with the governor or legislature. This railroad, for instance, particular railroads identified with your state funds it or your city funds it. It's an unbelievably complicated and, in my mind, ultimately unsuccessful discussion. I think the thing to do, if the goal, for instance, is to implement T-Rex, is to figure out ways to work around the existing governance and figuring out a way, as Seth said, to take the 74 and make it 54 and have additional sources of capital, because I think you could die on the governance hill and not get anything done.
Yeah, I agree with Pat, and I go back a little bit to the sense of the comment I made about easy pass and what people want. How can we get there without taking on that necessary battle? So to get the same results, you know, it's not the private sector going bankrupt. You know, government lives in perpetuity. And there's, I would also add the comment about the federal level, that to the degree we get federal funds, that, you know, the way that federal funding has gone for a whole evolution is MPOs. You have your TIP and all the federal funding that goes from that. So you look at where the two states and Amtrak tried to work together for Gateway, creation of Gateway Development Corp, and you saw the federal reaction to that. So, you know, and how problematic it is to get something that would allow us to move forward with the flexibility of a private sector model, but also be able to get federal funding. So there's a lot of complexity even if you had a consensus between the various stakeholders locally.
Well, and can I just add one thing? And I want to come back to the EDC model. And the lesson that I learned from EDC is that governance is important, but governance is not always the challenge. EDC was more effective than other city agencies, not because we had an outside board rather than reporting to the mayor. EDC was more effective because it wasn't subject to the same rules as city agencies. And I actually think that you could probably leave a lot of the governance in place at most of these transit agencies. But if you changed the rules under which they had to operate, that would have a dramatic impact.
When we had a discussion before, and one of the reasons we didn't want to delve deeply into governance is because it could be a rabbit hole. There's nobody here that doesn't realize that governance issues in some cases inhibit or prohibit things from going forward. Without peeling off scabs of semi-sealed wounds, you know, we'd be much further along with Gateway had one party not just exited that relationship. So that's one. But the creation of the Port Authority, the states of New York and New Jersey, was an action of the federal government, okay? And now's not the time to be taking issues to the federal government where we want their help in solving a problem that is regional in nature. But in answer to your question, I think we all recognize that. And some of the solutions that have been carved out in terms of how do you address the government's problem without a whole-scale change of governance is where the focus is. I think we've kind of run out of time because there's a general reception after this. I'd like to thank you for your participation. I was kind of watching people leaving the audience. There weren't that many. Thank you very much.